KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I believe in Europe, and I'm sure you believe too. And I urge you to act for your own sake.
World leaders react to the U.S.'s changing role in foreign policy. For Saturday, February 15th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. We head to Munich, where heads of state are meeting to discuss global safety. And across the Atlantic, we meet other people affected by our foreign policy proclamations in Panama.
The first person we met was this woman named Alejandrina Munoz, and she served us breakfast. And it was boiled yuca and eggs from the chickens that she raises.
And we chat with one Democratic lawmaker who's been duking it out on podcasts.
My view is that the media environment has changed, and it's more important to be out there to have people get a sense of who you are.
All that, and we talk about the movies that broke our hearts. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Hamas released three Israeli hostages today who were held in Gaza for more than 15 months, including a U.S. Israeli citizen. And Israel released more than 300 Palestinian prisoners and detainees, all as part of the fragile ceasefire deal that nearly collapsed this week. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi has more.
There are 369 of them. 36 were serving life sentences for convicted for attacks that killed Israelis. There's also quite a prominent member in this group. His name is Ahmed Barghouti, who was a senior aide to the man considered the leader of the Palestinian uprising in the early 2000s, of course, known as the Second Intifada. Ahmed Barghouti was in Israeli prison for more than 22 years. He was convicted for coordinating attacks that killed Israelis during the Second Intifada.
NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reporting. It's the sixth exchange so far in this six-week ceasefire deal, but officials say neither side has started negotiating the second phase, where Hamas was supposed to release all hostages. Those talks were supposed to have started a week ago. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is losing about 10% of its workforce as the Trump administration moves ahead with plans to shrink the nation's federal workforce. Jess Mador of member station WABE has more.
The Atlanta-based CDC is losing nearly 1,300 people with jobs classified as probationary. That includes newer hires and longtime staffers who've recently moved to new positions internally at the CDC. Affected workers are slated to get 4 weeks of paid administrative leave, according to an employee requesting anonymity because they're not authorized to speak for the agency. The layoffs are fueling fear across the public health community and among Democrats in Congress who say the cuts at CDC will leave the U.S. more vulnerable to disease outbreaks. For NPR News, I'm Jess Mador in Atlanta.
Clinics in Missouri will start offering abortion services after a Missouri judge granted a request to overturn licensing requirements for clinics that provide the procedure. St. Louis Public Radio's Sarah Fentman has more.
Missourians in November voted to enshrine the right to access an abortion in the state's constitution. After that, a Kansas City judge halted a near-total abortion ban that had been in place since 2022. But that order still left some restrictions in place, including a rule that providers give all patients pelvic exams. Clinicians in Missouri said some requirements were so strict, they still couldn't offer abortions. The judge's temporary order reversed her earlier decision and put a hold on the restrictions, saying they were discriminatory. Clinics in Missouri say they plan to begin offering abortions within days. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Fentum in St. Louis.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. Amazon workers in North Carolina voted against unionizing as the retail giant once again prevailed in its fight against labor organizing. Around 4,300 workers at a warehouse in Garner, North Carolina, that's a suburb of Raleigh, were eligible to cast ballots over the past week on whether to join the grassroots union called Carolina Amazonians United for Solidarity and Empowerment, or CAUSE. Workers voted nearly 3-1 against unionizing. Organizers at the warehouse wanted starting pay of $30 an hour compared to the current pay of $18 to $24 an hour. The union also wanted longer lunch breaks and increased vacation hours. It's not clear if they will challenge the outcome of the vote. President Trump this week became the latest U.S. president to say he wants to kill the penny. NPR's Maria Aspen has more.
There are some 240 billion pennies in circulation, but most of them are just sitting around, not being used. That means the U.S. Mint keeps on making more of them and losing tens of millions. It costs almost 4 cents to make each new 1 cent coin. President Trump says he's ordered his Treasury Secretary to stop making pennies. And unlike most of Trump's recent executive actions, this one is getting bipartisan support. Philip Diehl is a Democrat who ran the Mint in the 90s. He's been calling for the end of the penny since then.
All for it and long overdue.
Some other countries have already stopped producing their pennies. For example, Canada phased out its 1 cent coin more than a decade ago. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantsfoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong, in for Scott Detrow. European leaders are reacting strongly to Vice President J.D. Vance's address to the Munich Security Conference yesterday. Vance lectured his European colleagues about allowing far-right and populist political parties more space in Europe's political sphere. NPR's Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us from Munich to talk about this and other news that surfaced today at the conference. Hey, Rob.
Yeah, Andrew.
So Vance's speech yesterday received a very cool reception by European leaders. Not a lot of big applause breaks, right? What are you hearing there in Munich?
Well, I'm hearing across-the-board outrage from European delegations. This morning, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz began his address to the conference by calling out Vance. He said the day before Vance delivered his speech, Vance had visited the Dachau concentration camp where tens of thousands of people were killed in World War II, and Vance used the phrase never again when he spoke about the atrocities of the Holocaust. Scholz used that phrase to sort of lecture back at J.D. Vance, delivering a history lesson to the vice president, pointing out that Germany has learned to say never again to political parties like Germany's far-right Alternative for Germany party, known as the AfD, whose members sometimes trivialize the atrocities of the Nazis in World War II, and whose members also try to chip away at democracy, much like Hitler did during his rise to power. Here's what he said.
Deshalb werden wir es nicht akzeptieren, wenn Außenstehende zugunsten.
And Andrew, he's saying here, and this is the reason why we will not accept it when people who look at Germany from the outside come and intervene in our democracy and in our elections by supporting such a party. Scholz went on to say, allies and friends don't act like this, and we resolutely reject this.
Those are some pretty strong words from the German chancellor. One thing missing from Vance's speech was any mention of the Trump administration's plans to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Did the U.S. delegation make any progress on this in Munich?
Not really, no. I mean, President Trump's special envoy for Russia and Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, was in a session today. He was asked who would be at the negotiating table, and he answered Russia, Ukraine, and the United States, not Europe. You can imagine how that went over here in the heart of Europe. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke as well this morning, and he said that although he had met with Vice President Vance, there was a ways to go when it comes to negotiating an end to the war. Zelensky also brought up Vance's speech to make a key point to the European leaders assembled here. Here's what he said.
Yesterday here in Munich, the U.S. Vice President made it clear. Decades of the old relationship between Europe and America are ending. From now on, things will be different, and Europe needs to adjust to that. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe in Europe, and I'm sure you believe too. And I urge you to act for your own sake.
Act for your own sake. When he asks European leaders to do that, what does he mean?
Well, I think he means to, you know, you need to start taking care of yourself. He essentially said that we can no longer count on America to help defend Europe. And he added that, according to Ukrainian intelligence, Russian President Vladimir Putin is planning to move Russian troops to Belarus this coming summer. He warned that this could be the start of an eventual attack on bordering EU member states. And that is why he's calling on the European Union to establish its own military.
Huh. Well, what do EU members think of that idea of like a pan-European military force?
Right. You know, it's not a new idea. It's been floated as a solution to EU members' dismally low investments into their own militaries. But most military experts here don't think it's very realistic and that it would take too long to form. But someone who presented an alternative idea was European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Yesterday, in her address, she proposed a plan to ease the bloc's strict fiscal rules so that members are able to spend considerably more on their militaries. Now, EU members typically have to maintain debt-to-GDP ratios below 60%, and they're not allowed to maintain deficits above 3%. But von der Leyen says the EU will ease these rules up so that Europe can build its military capacity very quickly. And this is considered an emergency in the same way that the pandemic was, and this should free up billions of dollars worth of funds to bring Europe up to speed militarily.
That was NPR's Rob Schmitz joining us from the Munich Security Conference. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
The MAGA coalition is big and broad. There are purely capitalist factions, and there are groups who are anti-big business. There are people who are more than happy with what Elon Musk and his Doge crew are doing, upending the federal government. And then there's Sohrab Ahmari. He's a writer who comes from the perspective of the populist right. He's the U.S. editor of the website Unheard, that's a H-E-R-D, where he published a piece this week headlined, Elon Musk is a Danger to Trumpism. And he joins us now. Hey, Sohrab.
Good to be with you, Andrew.
So I don't want to put you in a box or anything, but I do want listeners to understand where you're coming from. So feel free to stop me if I say anything wrong here. You're a fan of President Trump in as much as he'd undo the neoliberal model, right, of, say, like the Clinton-Obama era. Now, as you saw Elon Musk make his moves, attempting to sort of cull the federal government, when did you start to get concerned?
Well, it was before the election, actually. I began to observe, like other people, Elon Musk's influence on then president too, but then candidate Trump. Especially there was an exchange in which the two of them were on an X, or formerly Twitter, space, at which President Trump praised Elon for firing workers who speak up at work or try to exert collective action. And so I wrote a column for the New Statesman in which I said Trump will have to choose between Elon Musk and populism. So what I think of as populism is just the recognition that ordinary people's problems have structural causes that have in part to do with the class structure.
Yeah, and then when, as he came into office again, you had sort of like your fears reinforced, I imagine?
Correct. By the way, there were other things that I was very much pleased about and have said so as well. I try to call balls and strikes. So, for example, President Trump's nominee to lead the Department of Labor, Representative Lori Chavez Duremer, is very well liked by organized labor, which I care about, and received praise for that. She's sponsored the PRO Act, which is the labor movement's number one legislative priority. But the fact that Elon Musk is so close to all these processes raises questions of self-dealing again, because obviously Elon Musk, before the election, launched a lawsuit trying to challenge the very constitutionality of the National Labor Relations Board, and therefore the National Labor Relations Act, our fundamental labor law that upholds collective bargaining and has since 1937. So it's troubling that someone who has an imminent, you know, pecuniary interest is the person pushing them forward. It again raises questions of self-dealing.
Yeah, you write in your piece of both the CFPB and the NLRB that, quote, trashing these agencies would do nothing to address the structural power imbalances which bedeviled Trump in America and which compelled it to vote for him in the first place. On the contrary, it would exacerbate the imbalances. Can you tell me a little bit more about those structural power imbalances?
Yeah, of course. I mean, in the case of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it involves customers being debanked based on their political views. Just before leaving, Rohit Chopra, the President Biden's now ousted director of the CFPB issued a proposed rule that would ban banks and other actors in the financial system from debanking customers based on their views. Most of the victims of debanking have been people who come from the right. So, for example, an evangelical crowdfunding site was booted from PayPal because it was raising funds for January 6th defendants. It was a very kind of an outstretched hand, let's say, to the populist right. However, Elon Musk said, delete CFPB, and now it's been deleted. So if you wanted to stop debanking,
that would have been
someone like
that
would have been a winner.
You know, there are populist leftists, say like the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party, or even people who are just fans of Lena Khan, right, the former FTC chair, who is pretty aggressive towards big tech. And those people might be banging their heads against the wall listening to this, right, shouting at the radio because like, of course, President Trump was going to hand power over to like the rich and powerful. All the signs were there. What would you say to that?
Well, I don't think that's true. I think the battle for the Trump inside the Trump administration is very much up for grabs between, you know, the two major factions, the populists and the techno-libertarian wing, let's say, led by Elon Musk. And the battle lines were drawn even before the inauguration. So, for example, over the issue of guest worker programs, which are a kind of indentured servitude. Speaking of Bernie Sanders, he opposed them strenuously and has continued to do so even as he's taken a softer line on immigration. So in this battle today, again, you find on the same side, you find the Bernie types and the Steve Bannon types on the one hand, and Elon Musk and other techno-libertarian types who want cheap tech labor, right? And the H-1B program is very useful for that because not only can you pay workers less, but those are workers whose ability to stay in the country is dependent on one employer. So it leaves them with almost no bargaining power. You know, that battle is ongoing.
What do you think it would take to get those other factions to you know, read this piece and be like, maybe he's onto something?
The way I see it is the great danger is this, is that, you know, Elon Musk has said he wants to cut $2 trillion from the federal budget. You know, for example, if Elon begins to claim that there is a gazillion dollars of waste in Social Security and Medicare and begins a kind of effective means testing where you have to sign up every year again and you have to be kind of qualified, which is an effective cut into the program. And if this, God forbid, happens against the backdrop of an economic downturn, that would be pretty dangerous for the right in 2026 and 2028.
You can read Sohrab Ahmari's piece on Unheard. It's titled, Elon Musk is a Danger to Trumpism. Sohrab, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Andrew.
This is NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Hamas today released three more male Israeli hostages held in Gaza, while Israel released more than 300 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. It's part of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas. It's the sixth coordinated release under the fragile deal. Investigators with the National Transportation Safety Board say the crew of the Army Black Hawk helicopter that collided with an American Airlines passenger jet near Washington last month may have had inaccurate altitude readings and may not have heard instructions from air traffic controllers. All 67 people on board the two aircraft were killed. And despite stubborn inflation and a lackluster report on retail spending, stocks gained ground this week as all of the major stock indices rose by more than 0.5%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. We've been rolling out a new series in recent weeks where host Scott Detrow sits down with fellow NPR hosts and reporters to hear what it takes to bring stories back from the field. I'm going to let Scott take it from here with the latest installment.
A few weeks ago, my co-host Ari Shapiro, along with producers and a photographer and interpreter, set out for the Panamanian jungle.
We started this journey hours before dawn. We woke up like 4 a.m. and we left Panama City. People in Panama told me nearly daily that this is the only place that you can get from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic in just an hour. And so that's the first part of the journey. You drive from the city of Panama City to Colón, which is going north from the Pacific to the Atlantic. And then you start to climb up into these jungly mountains. You work your way around these narrow turns until you finally come to this village.
I just want to hone in on the fact that driving from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean is the easy part of the trip.
Exactly. That's on the, like, well-paved, big, broad highway. It's easy.
They had arrived in Limón de Chagres, a village on a river called the Rio Indio.
The river is kind of the artery of this community. People fish in it to get food. They bathe and do laundry in it, and they go from one community to another. Somebody told me that before there were roads in this part of Panama, the river was their road. And so we got into this very long canoe with a motor on the back. It was quite long and narrow. And then we started motoring along, and when we pulled over at this mud bank, I wasn't quite sure why we were stopping there. And then somebody explained it to me.
Oligario, what are you showing us?
Aquí te voy mostrando.
This was the spot on the river where Panamanian authorities planned to build a dam that could soon displace the people of Limón de Chagres. So today, for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, we're on the road in Panama with my co-host Ari Shapiro. I started by asking how the fight over the Rio Indio Dam is connected to the main focus of that reporting trip, the Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal is running out of water. Panama is one of the rainiest countries in the world. People never thought it could run low on water, but every time a ship goes through the canal, more than 50 million gallons of fresh water from a man-made lake called Lake Atún just dump out and empty into the ocean. And a couple of years ago, Panama had a drought that was so severe the canal had to reduce traffic by a third, which has a huge impact on global shipping. So the canal authority has been looking for ways to get more fresh water to the canal, and they've basically zeroed in on one location where they intend to build a dam. And by building it, they are going to submerge entire communities. They've calculated that a little over 2,000 people will probably have to be relocated, and we wanted to go meet those people.
And it's interesting because we're trying to do these feature stories, these textured pieces that really involve a lot of putting you on the scene, writing, reporting, interviews, things that all take time. But you're trying in a trip like this to crunch it into a shorter period of time because you're trying to get as much out of this trip as possible, right? And like sometimes that creates tension as you approach a story. Was there an example on this particular story where you're thinking, I really need to get this right and make sure we have enough time for this angle of this reporting?
One of the things that was challenging was when we went to Limón de Chagres, we were very aware that this is a community that can be suspicious of outsiders, mm-hmm. and understandably so, because they feel like people have taken advantage of them. And so our fixer, Andrea, actually made a trip to the community ahead of our arrival, a week or two before we traveled, to introduce herself, to explain who we were, because we knew that when we got to Panama, we were going to have a very narrow window of time to come and visit these people and hear their stories. And if we showed up and they said, "Who are you? We don't trust you. Tell us about your intentions and come back tomorrow," we just didn't have that flexibility. And so Andrea laid the groundwork before we got there so that by the time we did arrive, these villagers knew who we were, they knew where we came from. And even then, during the interviews, I made sure ahead of time to explain who everybody on the team was, what we were going to do with the story. I was very clear, we are not activists. We do not work for the Canal Authority. We are American. We're going to tell their story, but we're not here to argue their case. And I would ask, do you all have any questions for us before we start these interviews? Because it's important to me to make sure that these people don't feel like they are being taken advantage of.
Yeah.
Because there's a big power differential there.
Right. And if you are doing your job right, the story is going to look very different at the end of the reporting than it did when you were sitting in a room in Washington, D.C. thinking up the original angle, right?
Completely.
You learn things, you observe things, you have conversations, the story changes. Was there something that jumps out to you that really changed this particular story as you got there and started talking to people and seeing it yourself?
I mean, there were two big things. One is that it turns out this drought was not directly caused by climate change. It was caused by El Nino, and the relationship with climate change is much more complicated. But the other thing is, before we went to this village, I talked to a former administrator of the Panama Canal who said these are people living a marginal lifestyle, was his phrase. He said they don't have clean potable water, they don't have reliable electricity, so I was expecting to show up and find a place of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And we rolled up, and the first person we met was this woman named Alejandrina Muñoz.
Muy buenos días, mi nombre es Alejandrina Muñoz.
And she served us breakfast, and it was boiled yuca and eggs from the chickens that she raises and coffee from the beans that she grows with sugar from the sugar cane in her garden. She told us that everything she eats comes from her garden or comes from the river. People in this community describe their lifestyle as one of abundance.
Bueno, nosotros aquí, usted sabe que nosotros en el campo, nosotros somos felices aquí.
They said relatives from the cities come and take extra food off their hands. And when I said to her, "Well, the Canal Authority says they're going to give you luxuries like running water and electricity," she said, "I've got solar panels, I have a TV, I have a phone charger. Water from mountain springs literally flows out of my faucet." She was washing dishes in the sink. And so to the people who live there, this is not a life of deprivation. It is a life of abundance. They described it as the Garden of Eden.
I mean, it sounds so idyllic when you describe it like that and when you hear people like her talking about that. What, if anything, is this community doing to try and push back on this project?
They are organizing. When we arrived, dozens of people from the surrounding communities that would be affected by this dam had all gathered to meet with us, and they showed up with all of these things that they had grown on their land and set them on a table as if to demonstrate this is not just any patch of earth.
Wow. Wow.
This is the most productive, fertile land you could imagine.
Wow.
And rice.
Wow.
So this table was spread with rice and plantains and coconuts and papayas and yuca and on and on and on. They stood up and they started chanting.
Nuestro río no se vende.
Nuestro río se defiende.
Nuestro río no se vende.
And some of these chants were like, "No se vende, se defiende," like our river's not for sale, we will defend it. And this is something that people told us they had been fighting for years. And even some who felt like they would probably lose this fight said, "At least I can tell my grandkids that I waged it."
And in your reporting, I understand that you were able to get some information about this project from the authority that even the people in the village hadn't been told yet. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Canal Authority has chosen this site to build a dam, but it was very unclear to us whether that decision was final or not. And we went back and forth, and as we were in the village, people said to us, "Hey, your questions make it sound like this is a done deal. Is it?" And I said to them, "I don't know, but we intend to interview people from the Canal Authority, and we will share with you what we learn." So after we got back to Washington, D.C., a senior official from the Canal Authority named John Langman agreed to do an interview with us, and I was able to ask him, "How final is this plan?" And he said, we have selected it as the main anchoring project. And I said, so like, it's no longer a question of whether the dam will be built. It's a decision that's been made. He said, it is a decision that has been made. Later in the conversation, I said, when do you plan to build it? He said, we intend to start in 2027. And so then I share that information with our fixer, Andrea, who went back to the people in the village, messaged them and said, here's what we learned from the conversation with the canal authority, which is not news that these people wanted to hear, but it's information that I think was valuable for them to know.
That is my co-host Ari Shapiro taking us behind the scenes of his recent reporting trip to Panama. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
President Trump's efforts to cut federal spending are having effects across the country. A wide-ranging spending freeze is hitting environmental projects especially hard as the administration works to unwind Biden-era climate policies. Colorado Public Radio's Ishan Takor visited two projects caught up in the freeze.
On a snowy, blustery afternoon, city planner Wade Broadhead is selling me on Pueblo, Colorado.
This is a local historic landmark, and it's been vacant now for about 2 years, and the windows are getting busted out, but it's got a great location right on the
There's no shortage of boarded up buildings here on Pueblo's east side, which is separated from the town by a highway and a railroad. But Broadhead doesn't really see that. Like a good planner, he sees potential.
Buildings, they see, oh, that's a good historic preservation tax project, or that's a good brownfields cleanup project.
One brownfields cleanup project is the El Centro Recreation Center. It's an old building, and it likely has lead and asbestos. Pueblo wants to revitalize it into a community hub. To clean it up and other sites in town, the city is counting on a $1 million grant from the federal government.
If we don't get buildings fixed up, eventually they get boarded up, they get burnt down. That's why these funds are so critical for us.
Pueblo formally accepted their grant from the Environmental Protection Agency in January. Then, less than a day later, the city got an email saying their funding was frozen. Broadhead said it felt like whiplash.
Tuesday was just a really confusing day.
And it was a really confusing day for cities across the country. The Trump administration ordered agencies to freeze and review federal funding, especially for climate and infrastructure projects funded under President Biden. Courts have ordered the Trump administration to lift that freeze. But lots of climate-related spending remains frozen. That includes money for the Owista Corporation in Longmont, Colorado.
We are still waiting for payment from the EPA via our payment system.
Crystal Cornelius is Owista's president and CEO. Her organization is expecting $156 million under a grant called Solar for All. They plan to distribute that money to help tribal communities install solar panels and lower energy bills. But when they log onto their government payment portal, Cornelius says their account was gone.
Upon trying to put in our information for payment, we are receiving an error code and that no accounts are found matching the criteria. So
Owista's already spent at least $2 million of their own money. Now, they have no idea when they'll be reimbursed, and they haven't gotten clear communication from the EPA. Owista's been doing this a long time. Their mission is to make sure affordable loans and credit are available to tribal communities to drive economic development. Cornelius has never seen a freeze like this, and she hopes it's only temporary because she says this program is a rare chance for tribal communities to make a dent in their energy bills.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and we've been waiting for once-in-a-lifetime opportunities.
Experts say this funding freeze is largely unprecedented. Martin Lockman is with the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University, and he says the government doesn't usually walk away from contracts it signs with organizations like Owista.
The government of the United States pays its debts. That is a kind of bedrock of the way our economy is built.
The EPA did not directly answer questions about funding for Solar for All grants in Colorado, saying only that the agency had identified inconsistencies in certain grants programs. But Pueblo has heard back from the EPA that their brownfields project is moving forwards, says Wade Broadhead.
We're really optimistic. Pueblo has a bunch of incredible historic sites, but they need a little bit of assistance to get back online.
Owista's hopeful the federal government will ultimately come through for them, too. For NPR News, I'm Ishan Takor in Denver, Colorado.
This is NPR News. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in America, accounting for 1 in 5 deaths in 2022. It is also the number one killer of women in the U.S. One thing that lowers your risk is cardio, the kind of exercise that gets your heart rate up so that your heart is really getting a workout. Mario Sagata, the host of NPR's Life Kit, tells us what counts as cardio, how intense it needs to be to get the benefits, and how much of it we need.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recommends that adults get 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise, 75 minutes of vigorous exercise, or some combination of the two, every week. And we'll get into what those terms mean. But cardiologist Dr. Jane Morgan says sometimes it's hard to get all that done, and you might feel overwhelmed if you're trying to keep track to that extent. So she tells people
to simply pick an activity that they like to do, and then to do that at least 5 times a week for at least 30 minutes. And the key is to really make certain that we are moving. Our bodies are made to move. Our bodies are really not made for the way that we live.
Now, cardio, simply put, is getting your heart rate up. And you'll use your heart rate to figure out how intensely you're exercising. First, though, you need to know your maximum heart rate. That's an upper limit, the estimated highest number of beats per minute that your heart can safely handle. Here's a simple formula.
220 minus your age. So if you're 30 years old, your maximum heart rate would be 190. It's 220 minus 30.
You're not aiming for that heart rate when you work out. Instead, you want to aim for your target rate, which is about 50 to 80% of your max heart rate. So if you're 30 years old and your max heart rate is 190,
then you take about 85% of that. So it can be 50 to 85%, not an exact science.
So your range would be between 95 and about 162 beats per minute. The lower end of that range would be considered moderate intensity exercise, and the higher end would be vigorous exercise. And to actually measure your heart rate while you're exercising, you could use a monitor or a smartwatch, or you can do this the old-fashioned way. Place 2 fingers against the side of your neck, next to your windpipe, until you feel your artery pulsating. Set a timer for 60 seconds and count the number of beats. Lots of activities can get your heart rate into the target zone. Swimming, biking, hiking, running, tennis, roller skating. And if you're thinking, I am a busy person, I do not have time for all that, try picking up the pace on activities you're already doing, like walking to the store or to the train, chasing your kids around, or doing yard work. By the way, Dr. Morgan says if you're trying to get 30 minutes of exercise a day, you don't need to get it all in one go.
So 3 or 4 times a day, take a 5 or 10 minute break and just do some type of exercise, even if it's going up and down the stairs or doing some deep knee bends or walking around the block. Those are called exercise snacks. And that shows long term that that increases your metabolism and also contributes to longevity.
The point is, get moving and do what you can when you can. This is another way you can take care of yourself. For NPR News, I'm Marielle Segarra.
For more Life Kit, go to lifekit.npr.org. NPR News.
A new thriller set among feuding farmers in Ireland deals with some weighty issues. Masculinity, violence, and yeah, all those sheep.
They were difficult because, you know, they don't really take direction. Kind of have their own method.
Director Christopher Andrews on his movie Bring Them Down. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is calling for the creation of an armed forces of Europe because he says the U.S. may no longer be counted on to support Europe. He made the comment at the Munich Security Conference. African leaders are meeting in Ethiopia this weekend for their annual summit, with conflicts in Democratic Republic of Congo and Sudan topping the agenda. Heavy fighting continues in both countries, especially the DRC, where rebels have seized another strategic city in the east. And two giant pandas in Hong Kong turn 6 months old today, but they don't have any names yet. A contest is underway to correct that. Hong Kong has the largest number of pandas living in captivity outside mainland China. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. At the end of the day, I'm just a guy in my mid-30s. And like millions of other guys out there, I spend my free time listening to other men chat about whatever for hours on end on various podcasts on YouTube. And lately, one guy has been showing up all over my feed.
We are being joined by Congressman Ro Khanna.
I get a DM from Ro Khanna's team. I think
so
your
we
team
are
was
fortunate to be joined this morning by Congressman Ro Khanna here in the studio.
Today's episode features a return appearance by Representative Ro Khanna.
Congressman Ro Khanna. Now, since the election, there's been all this discourse about whether or not the Democrats did enough to appeal to this world, to the world of podcast men, right? Like, how many times have you been in a conversation about whether or not Vice President Harris should have gone on Rogan? But it's been Congressman Khanna that's been out here in these podcast streets, and he joins us now to talk about his new media strategy. Congressman Khanna, hey, what's up, man?
Hey, this feels like a play that's talking about writing a play. You know, going to talk about
the media. I know, but bear with us. But, you know, this YouTube / podcast ecosystem isn't totally new for you. You know, I've seen you show up on politics-related podcasts before, but now you're hitting up, like, non-newsy, non-political podcasts, right? I saw some reporting that said that you're set to appear on The Adam Friedland Show, which is a comedy podcast. Talk to me a little bit about your thinking around your media strategy and how that's evolved.
Well, the lesson that a lot of people drew from the last campaign was, oh, Vice President Harris should go on Joe Rogan. But I think that's too simplistic. Of course, you should have gone on Joe Rogan. But the point is that there are all these podcasts reaching people that we need to be on. And that should be regardless of ideology, go on conservative podcasts, liberal podcasts. Also, it should be podcasts where people may not be talking about politics. And, you know, the amazing thing is, and I've told this to my colleagues, is a lot of these podcasts will be perfectly happy to have you on because for them it's a novelty to have a politician actually mixing it up. And so I hope more of my colleagues will reach out and realize that this is the way to get to so many voters.
Yeah. Why haven't more of them joined you in this sphere? I mean, a few of them have here and there, but you seem to be the most aggressive one. Where is everyone else at?
Well, it's a risk, right? The more you talk, the more you can misspeak, the more gaffes you can make. If you're going to be speaking for hours on end with especially a comedian who may make jokes that are offensive or may poke fun at you, that you may embarrass yourself. And my view is that the media environment has changed, that even if you do make a gaffe, it probably has a shelf life of 24 hours. And it's more important to be out there to have people get a sense of who you are.
I'm curious, how much of these appearances is it style over substance? And I don't mean that dismissively, right? Like, you know, you hit your talking points and the things you want to argue for. But is this also an attempt to show that Democrats as a whole can play ball, can take a joke, and aren't like weird, annoying scolds?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of it is just showing up. And it's being yourself, saying, hey, yeah, this is something I did wrong, or this is something I would have done differently, being willing to defend your view. I mean, if you go on some of these podcasts and pretend to be something you're not, it won't be authentic. One of the best ones I did actually was with Megyn Kelly, where I was defending transgender rights. And for 30 minutes, I mean, it was a heated conversation, civil, but she was pushing back on me. Mm-hmm. All of the comments were basically negative. But at the end, Megyn Kelly said, well, why don't you come back on my show? Now I know where you're coming from. We can discuss the economy. So I think it's just showing that you're not afraid to mix it up.
You represent Silicon Valley, and I'm curious, does the nature of your constituency allow you more leeway from the people you represent to show up on all these pods, right? Like, if someone from my district kept showing up on my YouTube feed, a part of me would think, like, we've got, like, potholes and other problems in your home district, dude, to worry about. And so, yeah, does that, like, offer you some freedom there?
That's a great point. The two reasons it offers freedom. One, Silicon Valley and my district is a very risk-taking place. And so they don't mind if I'm out there and mixing it up and doing things that are a bit on the edge. The second thing is that, yeah, they want me to show up, obviously, on cultural events and town halls and in the district. But they like the fact that I'm on podcasts and I get the online world and I'm engaging in the online world because many of them or their kids are doing that. And so for me, it actually is a positive given where I represent. The thing what I would say to someone who may not have the same kind of district is that it doesn't have to be national. There are a lot of influencers, there are a lot of podcasts that are very local to communities, and someone could make the decision, I just want to do them in my community, in my district, in my state, and it still would be beneficial.
As you've been doing this, as you've been talking to, quote unquote, the other side, have you learned anything about that group of people that you didn't know before?
One of the things going on to these podcasts, the approach I take is looking much more for actual dialogue and common ground. Now, people say, well, what's the point of that? Because a lot of the people, 95% of people listening to Tim Pool are never going to vote for me and probably won't vote for a Democrat. First of all, there is the 5 or 10% that may. But secondly, it's just showing that Democrats are unafraid, that we're willing to mix it up, that we're not afraid to have a debate about ideas. And I think that's so important for our party.
That was Congressman Ro Khanna. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And finally today, the latest installment from our series where we talk about some of our favorite films. Today's topic, the movies that make us cry. Here's Scott Detrow.
I believe it was Oscar-winning actress and unofficial patron saint of AMC Theaters, Nicole Kidman, who said it best.
Somehow, heartbreak feels good in a place like this.
The movies that can break our hearts tend to leave a mark. After dozens and dozens and dozens of viewings, I still choke up when Kevin Costner / Ray Kinsella gingerly approaches his dad on the ghostly baseball field.
Hey, Dad? You want to have a catch?
I'd like that.
Basic, I know. For others, a good cry might be Titanic, when Rose tells Jack she'll never let go as the flutes of my heart will go on softly waver.
I'll never let go. I promise.
On this Valentine's Day weekend, we are talking about the movies that make us cry with pop culture happy hour host Linda Holmes and All Things Considered producer Mark Rivers. Hey to both of you.
Hey, Scott.
Hello.
I'm already emotional talking about this.
Yeah, me too.
Hold it in, guys.
Let's start with the baseline here. Each of you, generally speaking, would you call yourself a crier at the movies, standard or not really? Linda, let's start with you.
I think I am a crier at the movies in inappropriate circumstances. But I mean, I also cry at certain things at home. I cry at certain things in the car. The car is really good for crying.
Yeah.
So sometimes with certain music, singing along. So, you know, lots of things.
The tears just flow for you, basically.
They do. I'm very in touch with my feelings in that way. I'm proud of that.
That's healthy, yeah. I would say historically for myself, I am not much of a cry at the movies. Mm-hmm. Growing up, I kind of prided myself. Like, I was kind of like Cuba Gooding Jr. and Jerry Maguire on the ESPN show where he's like, I'm not going to cry, Roy. That was kind of me growing up. The first movie I cried at was probably the third Lord of the Rings movie.
At what part?
It's when Frodo and Gandalf and the rest of them are kind of going off into the Undying Lands, leaving behind the Shire.
We set out to save the Shire, Sam. And it has been saved. But not for me. You don't mean that.
that actually provoked legitimate tears. But otherwise, I would say not much of a crier in the past, but since the COVID shutdowns, honestly, which I think have kind of made us all more emotional, I just never know what's going to hit me these days. So, you know, I think you can get a lump in my throat, but you got to earn it.
I think I'm definitely a crier at movies, and I have become more and more of a crier in recent years. I think there's certain genres that are always going to make that happen, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, like Pixar, like 90% average, mm-hmm. like when I'm seeing a Pixar movie for the first time.
It's like just, emotional it's terrorism hit. From yeah. those guys.
So let's walk through some of the different genres of heartbreak movies, because I feel like there's lots of different veins. Like, I'm thinking about the things that currently set me off are like the parent-child dynamics, like I mentioned, Field of Dreams up top. I feel like that is a traditional one, but there are many others. Linda, can you walk us through a few?
Yeah, I mean, I would say there's death. That's probably the biggest one for me. But as you say, Scott, it has a lot to do with what is going on in your own personal life. I think that when people are, you know, have little kids, they tend to cry at things that involve little kids. If you have aging parents, as I do, now that I am an older person myself, I think it becomes, you know, aging parent things that can make you cry. I don't tend to cry at sort of romantic movies as much. I tend to cry from depictions of loss, especially, I'm going to say, pets. If you put a pet in a movie and something happens to the pet, even more than with people, it's a really reliable way to get me to cry.
I go the complete opposite direction. The easiest way for you to get me to skip a movie is if you tell me it's about a man and his dog. The pet thing does not do anything for me, but I do agree with Linda about it depending a lot on your kind of situation in life. When you're watching a movie, I think loss is definitely a big factor when it comes to things that can get me emotional. And not just like loss of a life, but loss of childhood, right? I think about something like Toy Story 3, which is all about that kind of loss and moving on. I think,
oh my gosh,
that movie got a number of us in the theater. Not only when these toys are kind of, you know, spoiler alert for this movie that's like over 10 years old, but like not only when they're kind of facing this inferno with a kind of, you know, with this bravery,
and they hold each other's hands.
There's not a dry eye in the theater when that happens. But also when Andy is giving up his toys.
Yeah.
Now Woody, he's been my pal for as long as I can remember. He's brave, like a cowboy should be.
I think we can all relate to leaving behind a chapter of ourselves, and yeah, I think those are the ones that can kind of like really connect.
So it seems like neither of you are triggered by the happy tears as much, because that's one for me. Yeah. Like, I'm thinking of the last time I really, there's a few examples in the last few months, but one was the annual It's a Wonderful Life rewatch, where
sure.
everybody mm-hmm. comes together and the whole community is swooping into the room, and that's when I'm like,
movies like that feel almost booby-trapped to make you cry. Or I think about like Nicholas Sparks adaptations, where it feels like all the elements coming together are just designed right from the outset to make you cry. And I don't kind of like being blatantly worked around like that. I think when I'm going to cry at a movie, usually I don't see it coming, where it takes its emotional turn or the way they handle it is kind of unexpected. But with something like a Nicholas Sparks adaptation or maybe a classic Weepy, you kind of have the signifiers like pretty clear. Like, oh, look, there's the woman who's full of joy. Oh, look, there's the innocent kid. And then look out, there's cancer. You know, and those I just can't do, because yeah. I feel like I'm being messed with at that point, you know?
Sure. I will add that the idea of sort of the classic weepy is a very gendered idea. And a lot of these ones that you're talking about are movies that have traditionally been marketed to women. When you talk about kind of epic romances and, you know, something like Beaches, which is a great movie for crying. And I would argue that in some cases, you know, Saving Private Ryan is trying just as hard to make you cry as Beaches is, right?
Tell me I have led a good life.
What?
Tell me I'm a good man.
And so I think when you talk about the classic weepy idea, it's important to note that it can include something like The Notebook, but it also can include, I mean, this is a conversation they have during Sleepless in Seattle, the way that, you know, things make people cry for many different genres. So,
yeah, I think a weepy can include Best Years of Our Lives, the William Wyler film from 1946. This is about World War II veterans, you know, returning home and trying to reacclimate to life. And that's a weepy. They're following these three men and how they're adjusting or not adjusting to civilian life. And yeah, that movie is supposed to make you cry.
You wrote me that when you got home, you and I were going to be married. If you wrote that once, you wrote it 100 times. Isn't that true?
Yes, but things are different now.
So yeah, I definitely think weepies can transcend gender for sure.
So say somebody out there wants to test themselves, wants to well up this weekend. Mark, what's a movie you'd recommend?
So this movie is, again, it's a movie that I did not really expect to have a bigger emotional reaction to, but it kind of sneaks up on you, and it's called The Taste of Things. It's a 2023 film with Juliette Binoche, and she's this 19th century cook and also partnered with her husband who owns this kind of fine dining restaurant. And it's about the love and even art that you can put into living, you know, and how important that is, you know, to live a life that is worth cherishing and to show the people in your life that you cherish them through however you want to do it. And it conveys this so elegantly without speechifying, without, you know, the treacly broad sentimental score. And yeah, it's a quiet movie, but if you're involved in it, it'll sneak up on you. And I think it'll really hit you. I was tearing up in the theater, and then I was tearing up in the lobby as well, just thinking back on it. So yeah, for those who kind of want a quiet cry, you know, a kind of subtle cry, I would seek out The Taste of Things.
Linda, what about you?
We've talked about some of my favorites, Beaches and Inside Out. Philadelphia is another movie that made me cry a ton when I first saw it. I would also mention for a more recent movie, His Three Daughters, which is on Netflix and is about these three sisters who kind of get together to take care of their father as he's at the end of his life.
We all want your father to transition as peaceful as possible.
It's nice that it's us. This is the way it should be, the way he would want it.
I definitely sniffled my way through the end of that one. It has some wonderful performances. It has Elizabeth Olsen and Natasha Lyonne and Carrie Coon, and there's nothing not to like about that combination of actors, and it definitely got me in the gut.
Can I say something about Inside Out?
Yes.
I have this very specific memory of watching it in a theater for the first time, and of course just bawling and bawling and bawling.
I miss home. I miss Minnesota. You need me to be happy, but I want my old friends and my hockey team.
And the lights came up and people started to leave. And I remember this kid who might have been like 11 or 10 walking by, giving me this weird look and looking at his mom and being like, Mom, this is a cartoon. Isn't this for kids? What's this adult? And I'm like, you don't even know, kid. You have no idea.
He'll understand eventually. It's true. He'll get it.
It's true.
He'll get it.
Really good movie. That is NPR's Linda Holmes and Mark Rivers. Thanks to you both.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Did you ever know that you're my hero?
And I know you're crying because that's it for our show today. You've been listening to All Things Considered. We'll talk tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
Gone already, he gone to another world. Glory be to the Father, me I go meet him in another home.
Are we no go see him, are we no go see him no more? Are we no go see him, are we no go see him no more?
He left the wife and the children without one penny to spend. But it's only now that me realize, as a man lives, so shall he die.
Are we no go see him, are we no go see him no more? Are we no go see him, are we no go see him no more?
He used to be the little woman, he
His hobby was to sell up her face. But the day that she catch up the frying pan, look, she kill him in the market.